It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
One goal to win the title, it's as simple as that. Could it happen? Balotelli, Aguero! And Mo Farah's coming down the straightaway, and he's going to be attacked by Deborah Meskel, and Mo Farah's got the double! He's the Olympic champion again.
Two to win. It's got to throw, it's got to go to the keeper's end. He's got it! England have won the World Cup! By the barest of all margins!
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Barest of Margins podcast with me, Simon Hughes. This is the show that delves deeper into the world of sport to discover how athletes and sports players derive marginal gains from the specialist trainers and scientists they work with, or the innovative techniques or strategies they use that enable them to, hopefully, triumph over their opponents and try to realise their dreams. Today, we're looking at that glorious relationship between cricket and food. Lunches and teas are, of course, a huge part of the game. I mean, what other sport stops every so often so the players and spectators can get stuck into a large meal? For some cricket people, it's their favourite bit. It's certainly one of mine. With my home ground at Lord's, I was spoilt with the array of main courses and desserts we were offered at lunch. Huge portions of chicken chasseur, lamb cutlets, roast beef and Yorkshire puddings and all the trimmings, and everyone was gorging themselves. And then there was the spread of jam and cream, scones, iced cakes, macaroons and other fancies that were wheeled in at tea, which rivalled Fortnum & Mason. Times have changed, of course, at professional level anyway, and now England employ a nutritionist to make sure the players are eating the right things, and enough of it too. But it's reassuring to hear that in the England dressing room it's not all just protein shakes and granola bars. The bowlers, in particular, are encouraged to pig out. But what are the best things for a cricketer to eat? How much? And when? What should they avoid? And can they still have some treats? Please! All will be revealed by today's guests, Phil Scott, England's lead fitness performance coach, and Emma Gardner, the team's resident nutritionist. And the first thing I asked them was, what are their daily responsibilities?
So, job description, I guess, as the S&C physical performance coach and nutritionist, we fit into a bigger, wider team fundamentally. There's as I guess people are aware, backroom staff has grown over a number of years. So we've got doc, physio, psych. We've obviously feed into the coaches and captains as well. And my personal responsibilities is prepping the players to, I guess, get ready to play a test match and then be able to repeat that. So getting them aerobically fit, strong enough to cope with the demands and robust enough to cope with those demands. Getting them as fast as we can as well from that speed point of view. And then that repeatability. So I guess this is where our roles start to broaden out a bit as well in terms of in looking at recovery between games and it starts to become multidisciplinary. So within that, I personally, along with our other S&C Rob Arman, will look at the programs that will be done alongside the physios, and getting specific around exactly what these players need. And that's, yeah, that's, I guess, day to day away from the game, is what I get up to.
So I have been with England Men since 2017, which seems like a long time now, but in my role kind of, you know, runs parallel to what Phil just described there. In terms of, essentially, in simple terms, I help them with what they should be eating to underpin their training and obviously their performance, their cricket performance. But I suppose, you know, my day-to-day role goes beyond that, really. So nutrition is a discipline which aligns to a lot of other disciplines. So it might be, for example, working with the physios if a player is rehabbing and what they should be eating there to speed up their recovery. It might be working with the doctor when we travel to, you know, countries where we may have a higher prevalence of illness to try and minimise that. It might be working with psychology around food when we're living in bubbles, as, you know, as per the last 2 years. You know, so it really depends. But I suppose my black and white job on paper is to prepare them nutritionally for the demands, similar to what Phil said, of test cricket and one day cricket, T20s, and ensure that they're fueled well enough to perform and that they recover, so that, as we said, they're able to repeat that. Because what we've come to figure, particularly in the last 5 years, is the game of cricket has really transitioned and is quite physically demanding. And we now have research to confirm that. And therefore, you know, whereas they were probably once seen as players who stood in a field for several hours and didn't do very much, we now know, you know, there is a lot physically that they have to do and sustain. And nutrition, therefore, plays a big part in how we get them able to sustain that performance.
I wonder if people who play amateur cricket will be listening to this with dismay, because they'll be thinking, you know, I love my steak and kidney pudding at the club for lunch and, you know, a big, like, load of cakes and scones and things for tea. Actually, I mean, before we kind of get into the detail of it, can you still enjoy food as a cricketer, as a professional cricketer?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, Simon, like, you know, these guys tour for 285 days of the year. So to expect them to eat, you know, the perception is that they eat perfectly 285 days a year is unrealistic. We know that they don't. So I think the reality is, you know, it's them understanding what they need as an athlete to perform, but then also, you know, understanding that they're a human being who wants to enjoy food like any person does, and I want them to. And I think another aspect of my job with these guys, especially over the last 5 years, has been educating them around lifestyle and health as well, and them finding a balance between, you know, regardless of whether an athlete or not, what is just a decent diet, and when do they pick their opportunities to actually relax and eat a bit of rubbish or whatever they want to eat. And I want them to find that balance. I would like to say that the players would say I have a fair expectation of what we encourage them to do, but they have choice like anybody. We don't make it so strict that they don't have choice. It's up to them to make the educational choice which is best for what they need.
Phil, you've looked into this. I know we talked about this before, you know, in the past, probably before you got teamed up with Emma. So have you got some sort of research or, you know, data that you could share about the processes of how to find what is the best thing to eat for a cricketer?
To work out what they need, you've got to work out what they're doing. So, and that's where I guess Emma and I have collaborated, what we believe as well. Over the last few years, we've collected a lot of information about what they actually do on the field between test match, one days and T20s. And it's been quite staggering and mind-blowing, and also very informative for myself. But once you give the players their information about themselves, most reactions have been, wow, I didn't realise I quite do that. So since we've been able to give the information, let me give you an example. So for a test match, if a bowler was to bowl an average or bowl 40 overs, the average amount of distance that will be covered is around 50k for that test match, which is a lot of distance. That's excluding the two training days, which is probably around another 7 to 10K of training. So if you're looking at around 60K a week, whilst running in at 24, 25Ks an hour for a bowler and 17 hours of fielding on your feet and numerous sprints as well to the boundary in between the wickets, that's a lot of energy. And our first step, I guess, was to kind of show the guys that you do a serious amount of work. If you aren't putting the right fuel into you, then you're not, it's like, you know, you're gonna run out of petrol, basically. You're gonna run out of fuel. So, and I think once we had that information, they were open to it. And then that's when Emma's come in terms of the actual detail of what they need and why and when. And that has been the big difference. Because I take away just the performance side on the field, but even training, where we've got to in recent years is, I believe, a very good level of athleticism. But it got to the point where I think they needed to be upskilled nutritionally to go to that next level. Because we said to them, didn't we, if we push you any harder, we're going to break you. You're ready to be pushed harder physically, but you need to be fueled, otherwise you're not going to sustain it and we can guarantee you an injury. And that's when, in the last couple of years, they've been excellent. I think we've taken real steps forward. But the details is over to Emma, really, from that point.
I'm gone then, Emma. What is the detail? Can you kind of be a bit more specific about what is good and what is bad for these, let's say, for a fast bowler then?
Yeah, so I think the first thing, you know, when we presented to them what Phil just described there in terms of the physical demands and, you know, we actually put in front of them, you will run an average of 50 kilometres, you will do this, and they were surprised. But then we said, you know, how many of you back in 2017, 2018, and I'll confess, I said, how many of you eat breakfast? And some of them wouldn't even eat breakfast before going into a test match, which, you know, we were like, how is any person going to perform optimally, regardless of whether you're probably an athlete or you're not an athlete, if you don't even have any, as Phil rightly said, we almost use the car analogy with them, any fuel in your tank. So we just started to piece together how, almost like what it should be and how much it should be. And I think the biggest learning I've had with these guys is the majority of them under-eat, particularly our fast bowlers, for their physical outputs. So we've had to work a huge amount on breakfast. And then, you know, kind of coming back to your steak and ale pie in a cake, it's looking at the composition of that meal, what is optimal. At the end of the day, we see test cricket as an endurance event. For an endurance event, I'm sure if you speak to other people on this podcast, they're going to say, what fuel do you need? They're going to say carbohydrate, as an example. Well, a cake and a steak and ale pie, as lovely as they are not predominantly carbohydrate. So therefore, we've had to, you know, what I've had to do is essentially do simple swaps with the guys to go at breakfast rather than having hash brown, sausage and bacon, which is all predominantly protein and fat. Can we put some decent carbohydrate options in there, please? And we've kind of nudged them across to what they need and when. And, you know, I would say the main two areas we've worked on are the amount that they eat and also the regularity of that eating. So rather than just eating breakfast and then nothing throughout the day, like a car, we're like, you need to top up your fuel. So if they're bowling all day, we so often used to see that players would drop off in speeds in the final session of the day, for example, or that's the time when people feel fatigued. And naturally that will happen if they don't have energy there available to do that. And probably more importantly, you know, we've probably emphasised the recovery aspect as well, because we all know that if you want to win a series or if you want to win a World Cup, it's the team who are still winning at the end that are going to win, essentially. And it's all well and good being prepared for one-off matches, but what we've tried to instill in the lads is we want you to be able to sustain your performance in match 9 of a World Cup, not just match 1, 2, and 3, because the goal is at the end, isn't it? And that's probably where we've worked. So what's nice is, as Phil said, we've got genuine data now to show what they actually do. And I suppose our gauge of are we successful is simple things. Are they maintaining their bowling speeds in the last session of the day? Are they less sore on day 4 or 5 of a test match? Are they able to sustain their physical outputs on match 9 of a World Cup? That's the tangible bit for us to measure, not just necessarily win-loss, which obviously we'd love to attribute it to that, but we would like to think that contributes to our percentage chances of winning, of course, if we know that the guys are physically ready and they're fueled, able to deliver what we need them to.
So just to bore into the detail a bit more, I mean, let's say you've got Stuart Broad about to play a test match. I know every individual has sort of different preferences, but what would be the ideal breakfast for him, given he might be bowling 20 overs in the day?
Generally, for our fast bowlers, it would comprise something along the lines of this. A large bowl of porridge with a banana, say, sliced into it and some honey on top or some kind of fruit. Two or three slices of toast with some eggs and probably some kind of protein. Some of the guys do like a bacon or a smoked salmon, something like that. And then the really, really good ones, that would be minimum. We'd then get them to the ground. So they'd eat that back at the hotel. We get them to the ground and we top them up again. So generally we tend to do something a bit easier, like a smoothie, which might be milk-based with some banana blitzed in, some more, you know, more fruit. And we, because again, like, you know, a test match often starts at 11. My rule to these guys is they shouldn't go longer than 3 hours without eating something. So most would have already had the breakfast at 8, 9 o'clock. And the other thing that I found fascinating when I started working in cricket is even the warm-up can be quite physically demanding, which again, I've learned from Phil. So you've got to think that that fuel tank is always being depleted. So we top them up again at 11 o'clock. And then obviously they play through to one and we just keep topping them up through the day. But, you know, for context, a lot of our guys, when I started with them, it was either we don't eat breakfast or it was I have one slice of toast with some sausage, egg and beans. And they're having about a fifth of what they actually need there. So we've just re-educated them on what is actually enough. And don't get me wrong, Simon, it depends on who's doing what. So a batter might not have as much as that as a fast bowler and so on. But that's an education. And the most difficult thing about cricket is you could prepare a batter, for example, to bat for several hours and he could get out first ball. So you can fuel them, but it's then what they do after that, obviously depending on where they are in the game. A fast bowler is much easier because it's quite linear. We kind of know what they're going to do. We know the expectation, whereas a batter can be completely dependent. Similarly to a spinner, you might play a spinner and then the wicket, we don't end up playing them because, you know, whatever happens in the game. So we have to be quite flexible and adaptable in our approach with them.
It's interesting, actually, what you say about topping them up even before play starts, after the hotel breakfast, because I always used to be slightly cynical of the likes of Mike Gatting, who I played with at Lords, having a bacon sandwich at 10 o'clock, having had a massive fry-up at 7:30, 8 o'clock. I mean, you know, sort of thinking, God, what is he doing? But in a way, he was on the right lines. Maybe the bacon sandwich wasn't ideal, but he was on the right lines about, you know, constantly sort of topping himself up. What about caffeine? The runner that I've spent some time with, Stephen Scullion, the runner from Ireland, he's absolutely passionate about his coffee before he goes out training. So where do you sit on that?
Yeah, caffeine is a really interesting supplement for cricket. And I think almost my description of how we use it would vary depending on the format. So, you know, the thing with Test cricket is it's an extremely long day. So you can be quite tactical with when we would use caffeine. For example, the last session of the day when maybe they're starting to feel a bit more fatigued. But then the reality is the later that you utilise that caffeine, then the longer it's technically within the system, and then that could affect sleep. So, and likewise, you could argue in a format like T20, when you want to get, you know, a stimulant in them to, because they want to, you know, hit it as hard as they can, and it's a quick fire power type game. Caffeine is very, very high use within our dressing room, particularly in T20 cricket. But the problem we have there is a lot of the games are played at night time. So in summary to your question, Simon, yeah, we absolutely use caffeine, but we've had to give education to players on when they use it, how they use it, and the timing of when they use it as well. Because at the end of the day, if we move into recovery is important for them, sleep's important for them. The last thing I would say, though, is with cricket, there's always a coffee machine somewhere, and there's a lot of boredom drinking coffee. So we found with some of the guys, they were having 7, 8, 9 coffees a day just because we're batting and they're not batting and they're just bored. And again, there's an education around that, because you can build up a sensitivity to caffeine if you habitually have it a lot. So you almost lose the sensitivity of the caffeine when you then start having it. So it's all had to be an education, but it makes sense to use caffeine in cricket. As I said, we use it very differently depending on the format.
Now, I call this podcast The Barest of Margins, and appropriately, Phil and Emma, you were both involved with the England team when you won the World Cup in 2019 by the barest of margins. Ben Stokes, kind of his endurance and sort of strength and power, managing sort of his resilience in that game was incredible. How much could you put that down to what he ate?
I'll pass to Phil in a minute, because there's absolutely no doubt the physical training, and I'll let Phil talk about that we did, was he did and Phil did, was phenomenal. But do you know what? He's quite a good example of a journey that we've been on nutritionally. And, you know, to give some context, and I'm sure he would be happy for me to share, earlier in the stages of that World Cup, we worked a lot on his eating, because we were finding, because his outputs were so high, and going back to the example I used before, you know, players, not just him, would regularly cramp. And many, many people in sport attribute cramp to dehydration or lack of fluid. And these guys never, they're used to playing in very warm conditions. They drink a lot. And for me, we'd done specific testing to look at, you know, could it be linked to that? And something, you know, my gut feeling, no pun intended, was it's not hydration that's the issue in these guys. It's the fact their muscles, I'm going to put this in very basic terms, have got nothing in them and are therefore craving, you know, energy again. And early on in one of the group stage matches, he'd come off and he was cramping quite early on, as were some of the other guys. And I said, I remember it vividly, because Phil said to me, "Stokes, he's cramping." And I looked at his plate and I said, "Well, that's obvious why." And it was a funny moment, wasn't it? Because he said, "Well, what do you mean, Em?" And I said, you're not eating enough carbohydrate for your outputs. You know, you're beasting yourself, as he always does in a fantastic way for us. But you're not putting the energy in to match your output. And from that moment, he actually started to properly fuel himself. And when the guys won the World Cup at the end, it's one, don't get me wrong, Simon, it's one minor component in a lot of variables in why people get to that stage. But we both said to each other, if we hadn't have had that conversation 4, 5, 6 matches before, who knows what the outcome would have been? Because we needed him to understand that, and right to that very last Super Over, he fueled himself. He came off and he fueled in those very few minutes. Phil was throwing a, you know, carbohydrate down his neck. And, you know, he went on a real journey in many, many areas, but the nutritional component was definitely an aspect of it. And I'm keen for Phil to speak in a second around. He didn't get there by chance physically either. There was a massive component of that. But I think it's quite satisfying for us as a physical prep team to go, we had a tangible example there of... And the guys saw that and went, wow, okay. Sometimes we can speak a good game and we can talk about science, but they have to experience it to believe it. And I think that was a big pivotal moment for us with our lads, because they actually realised that you don't be able to physically give that in a World Cup final without a lot of work and prior planning before. And it doesn't happen by chance. Yes, you have a lot of things on your side for that to happen, but he did exactly what we asked him to do, and fortunately we got the outcome that we want. But I'll pass to Phil to talk about his physical side.
So I think to take you one step further back, I think beginning of 2018, Joss Butler, we had a conversation, again, a similar conversation, but from a physical training point of view and a nutritional point of view, and Joss said, "I'm going for it, I'm all in." And particularly where I think, I don't know if you were in Sri Lanka at the end of that year, and you would see Joss and Stokesy particularly push themselves really hard before the game, mid-game, and they were starting to learn, both of them, and show the rest of the team that you can train that hard, that consistently, through a series. Some of the power outputs that we had from Joss at the beginning of the season of 2018 and our summer to the end, he was peaking, I remember, at Headingley in our last game of the series at the end of the summer. And he'd blown away, it was a beautiful story for us, or for me, because he'd blown away all the myths that you can't progress through a season and that you can only maintain. And these guys, particularly Joss and Stokes, he led, people started to follow, and they learned that they could actually train hard in the gym, around the field in terms of their aerobic development and their speed. But also it started to complement their cricket, and they can start to feel it. And as Em said, and I'm a big believer of, I don't think you understand things until you've felt it and until you've put yourself in that position. And although you can accept that, yeah, fueling's really important and being strong is really important, until you felt that ball go a bit harder, a bit faster, or you've got to that boundary a bit quicker and you've gone, oh, wow, I've got some more in me. You don't believe it. And that's okay, but it takes someone to make those steps to get to that point. And I think there's a couple of pivotal moments there that they started to believe, and I thankfully we had those conversations, and thankfully they took them on. And absolutely, you've got to have, we had some serious luck at points, but you know, they put themselves in that position to take advantage of that luck, I guess.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
How easy is it to implement these ideas to sportsmen or women who are sort of reared on pleasurable food as cricket is associated with?
In simple terms, extremely difficult. I think, you know, if I'm truly honest, I started in 2017. It took me 3 years, realistically, to start to change the belief system, to challenge the culture a little bit of cricket, which was quite uncomfortable for some people because, as you said, Simon, it's steeped in history. You know, the Lord's Lunch is a classic Lord's Lunch, and people don't want to change that. And, you know, we had to essentially go, what do these guys, what does it take to win? And therefore, how do we put pillars in place to help them win? And that involved having some uncomfortable conversations in their environment. You know, I essentially took them on a journey of optimize the environment was like my number one objective. So change the environment to nudge them to make better choices, which was quite uncomfortable. And then obviously optimize their athleticism, which we've kind of just talked about. And then I had a couple of other objectives which came later. But I would say it took me 3 years to get them to a position where they were ready to not listen. They were always wanting to listen, but to believe it, and as Phil said, and also as well, Simon, like, we're a big team, you know, it's not just the players, it's also the coaches, and it's the support staff have to buy into that. And they had to build, you know, a bit of a trust and a respect in my role to go, yeah, actually, Em's doing a good job and he's helping us contribute to winning, hopefully. But in simple terms, it's really challenging, really, really challenging. And also, nutrition is so personal to every person who walks this earth, because food instills emotions in us and it's a pleasurable thing to do. And the last thing you want these guys to feel like they are is robots that, you know, or cars where you just fill them up and let them run and that's it. And especially, as I said, in a sport like cricket, where we play for hours on end, we tour for weeks and months on end, food is a comfort to a lot of people, staff and players. So, you know, there's times when these guys go, I don't want to eat that, I want to eat that. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. But let's just build a nice foundation for you to perform, because then those little speed bumps or those blowouts become less impactful to them. And I feel like now we've got a nice balance with these guys where they're either on it and they know they're on it, they're performing, but then when they're away from it, they relax. And that's not as costly to us as probably historically it was before.
How do you prove it works?
It's kind of what we came back to before. We knew physically what they needed to achieve, and our marker is, could they physically achieve that and could they physically sustain that? So, you know, a really good example is we have data. Phil collects all the GPS data. We can look at, has that bowler maintained his speed, his distance covered? Have they fielded, you know, on their average? Are we doing as well in match five, test five, as we are in match one? Physically, where are they? We measure them. Obviously, we do diagnostic fitness testing with them. Do they maintain themselves? And historically, as an example, we used to see them really yo-yo up and down. So they'd like make improvements through the summer. Then we'd hit the period before the winter and we'd fly back up the graph and regress. And then we'd crash back down again. And that was unsustainable. But also the inconsistency made us more vulnerable to injury and illness. And that was another presentation we did to the guys. We stood in front of them and went, guys, this is your graph and this is what we do with. And we were literally up and down, up and down, up and down. Can we create more consistency? And they have. So that's another measure for us of consistency in those markers. But I suppose ultimately, you know, to give a more practical example, can a batter go in and sustain himself for several hours in heat in Sri Lanka, as an example, last year? We've never seen more of our lads be able to do that. In those conditions, and when we put them to the extremes of heat, of humidity, and we ask them to bat, for example, for several hours. In the past, we often saw, you know, players get out in the 50s and they wouldn't necessarily back up to the hundreds. And, you know, now so often we see our lads and they come off at tea and they're like, I'm feeling good. And they're 100 or not out, hopefully. And, you know, in the past, we probably had guys going, I'm really struggling now. So it's hard to measure. It's a very difficult subject, nutrition and physical, you know, S&C to measure. But I think we've got a lot of good examples to show. Hopefully we've made some good gains with these guys.
My favourite biscuits in Lidl's dressing room were always custard creams. And they were knocking around with chocolate bourbons and stuff. And, you know, when you were having a bit of a sort of low moment, you just grab a quick bourbon. So what do you have sort of knocking around the dressing room now to A, deter that sort of biscuit addiction, and B, that's actually healthy?
Yeah. So Lords, I think, you know, I love my meetings with Lords, because we've known each other now for 5 years. And I remember one of my first meetings with them was, is there any chance I could change the tea break? And honestly, they looked at me like, no, you're gone. That's steeped in history. And I think what's been nice is we've had to build a mutual respect, and we haven't completely wiped it out. It was something I was really conscious of in my first year. If I could have quite easily gone in and gone, remove that. But I knew I would have lost people. And again, it's the emotional connection to it. And the lads love Lords. They look forward, for example, to the lunch there. They look forward to the tea break. And therefore, we've had to take them, as I said, on a bit of a journey and a transition to nudge them in a better direction, but not completely go cold turkey, we're going to remove it. So as an example, you know, we will still have a dessert on there at lunch, but now there's an alternative dessert so they can make the choice. And so there might be your sticky toffee pudding, but there's, you know, a better option there. And similarly in the dressing room, you know, rather than it being cakes or biscuits is a good example, we educate the lads on, like, if you like a chocolate bar, here's a better version of that chocolate bar. Or if you like a biscuit, here's a better version of that biscuit. Or if you like sweets, here's some popcorn, you know. And also on day five, we relax. And, you know, I say to Lords, bring that in at tea break, you know, or after the game. Because, you know, they've worked hard. You want them to enjoy it. But I think in summary, what we've done is we've created choice and we've educated them so they have that choice to make. And don't get me wrong, some of the lads still walk past me with their sticky toffee pudding at lunch and smile at me and go, I can't not him. And I'm like, that's fine. But, you know, I remember on the World Cup final, actually, the day before is probably the only time I've put a message on the group that did say, lads, if there's ever a time to think about that dessert on the Lord's lunch, it's tomorrow, because you do not want to be, as we said, we went to a super over, you do not want to be lethargic and full and full of fat when you need to run quickly. And I think the difference now is the lads not only respect that, but they know why. I think before they just, you know, we said we've been on a massive journey of education with them.
I think the other thing I've noticed is since the guys have taken on board the quality, the quantity and the timing of the food, they're not craving rubbish naturally. It's the natural, I think, if anyone out there at all has ever eaten well, those cravings for rubbish at snack time or at a certain moment start to disappear. And since these guys have been consistent with that over the last X number of years, as Em says, they've always got the choice, but 90% of the time they're now making the right choice, but also because they want to, and they, I guess, physiologically don't need that. I don't have that craving for the rubbish, and then they get the bonus of knowing that that's actually going to benefit me on the field. So away from, and I think that's where we see the consistency, when they've gone away from us and there are those options, they become habits, which suddenly this that slightly more positive habit cycle gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and they come back in good shape, better shape sometimes than they even left us, because they're free to make those choices themselves. So once the ball starts rolling, it starts moving slowly, but I think it picks up at a lot of pace, like a snowball, really.
Yeah.
The old snowball effect.
We're
starting to see that particularly.
Yeah, and I just said, I think the true test is when they're away from us now, and they maybe go and play a county game somewhere. And if the food isn't very good, they'll often complain about that. So they'll go, well, how are we meant to perform with it? You know, or they might make comment that it's not up to what they want it to be. And I think, to be fair, Simon, that's the true test of when there is often rubbish on a menu, they now will comment on that, you know, because they go, is this optimal for what we need? And they're making that choice and they're making those decisions. And I think that's satisfying for me, because I go, you're not just actually going, woohoo, there's rubbish on here today. It's going, is this actually optimal for what I need as a player? Which is good.
Mark Wood has portrayed a nice image of during that World Cup final of when, I think it was when there was that six ricocheted off Stokes's bat and the dressing room went mad. And Jason Roy, I think, was either on the dressing room table or close to it and sort of banged it, and all these cashew nuts and raisins were sort of scattered in all directions. So Woody says when he came back in, having been run out, he was sort of treading on all these sort of bits of food that had been knocked over. But that sounds like, you know, at least it was healthy food, I suppose.
Yeah, corks flying everywhere. Yeah, I think so. It's changed. It has changed. But it's funny, you know, the wider game of cricket, there are still traditions. And it's funny, I still, you know, regularly when we do things like this, you speak about, you know, club cricket and so on. And I get sent pictures sometimes like going, what do you think of this tea break? And it's, you know, deep fried tea. It almost looks like a children's tea party. And I'm like, well, that's fine though, because if that's what you want it to be, then so be it. I think at the end of the day, you know, we are an international cricket team and we have to create a professional environment for these lads. And what's nice is they recognise that and they're quite proud of that, I think, now. But it's not dismissing cricket and where it's been and where it's come from and where it still is in a lot of places. And I quite like that. I like it. And what's nice is when lads come from county cricket up to senior cricket, they see and they feel a difference. You know, I'm not saying like it's better and bigger and better, but, you know, it should feel professional. Because we're meant to be elite and we want to create an environment that allows them to be that while still allowing them to go back and enjoy cricket and a custard cream and a bourbon biscuit if they want to.
Just leads me on to the vexed subject of alcohol, which I know you've got views on, Phil. So where does that fit into this? And you know, can you have a drink after you've won a game?
Yeah, absolutely we do. I think, again, the journey... cricket's got... This fits into the history of cricket. I mean, years ago, we're talking pints on the table at lunchtime. I mean...
Yeah, you know, Bumble on my Virtual Cricket Club show recently said, first test, Lords, he made 46 at lunch, and he thought, I'm so happy with making 46 on my debut, not out. Came off, had a beer, had a pint of lager at lunch... was out straight after.
I mean, that supports us a little bit. Yeah. But there was beers on the table at lunch. There was, I think I'm right in saying it was 3 days of play, 1 day rest, and then finish off with two. And I've heard the odd story that people may enjoy themselves, you know, on that day four off. That's what we've come from. I think we've gone on a big journey with it, with the guys. And again, through education and choice, and at no point have we ever said, right, you're not allowed any. I mean, that's not going to work. It's absolutely not going to work. But it's the timing and the quantity of that beer. And yeah, absolutely. You finish a test match, have a beer, guys. But if you have 10, it's going to start affecting the game, which happens because we play so much and back to back in 3 days' time. And although it's quite hard to collect data on alcohol and the effects at international or professional sport level, there is the odd bit of information out there that has indirectly been collected, and it's not published, not out there, so it's not technically official, but there is clear evidence and it's obvious. We all feel it. If you have X number of beers, you're still struggling 3 or 4 days later. That run you do 2 days later, even if you're just jogging around the park, you're feeling empty. But I guess we're asking, we're in a situation where these guys are going to have to go out and repeat another 50K in front of 35,000 people with their jobs on the line and their reputations, and it be expected to bowl 90 miles an hour, score hundreds and chase balls down to the boundary. So I think through education and I think what I mentioned earlier in terms of they've got themselves in a position now nutritionally and physically where they're proud of their of what they can do. You also, when you start feeling good, and again, this goes for everyone out there, when you start feeling good and then you get put off kilter a little bit, you notice it more than if you're not that healthy and you have 10 beers anyway. If you're really healthy and you have 2 beers, you go, oof, that doesn't sit so well with me anymore. So the snowball effect fits into that as well, I believe. The guys have a beer at the end of the test match, but you know, we've been consistent, I think, now for a while of they know what they're heading into and they know they want to perform, and that's pretty much as far as it goes. Touch wood.
Okay, so to finish, Ben Stokes is the new England Test captain. So, Emma, give us a sort of sense of what you would prescribe for him for a day's diet, you know, at the beginning of a game, say, where you don't know whether he's going to bat or bowl. And how can that selection of food be applicable to a club cricketer as well?
Yeah, and I think, Sammy, it's not just for Ben. I mean, generally, as much as I kind of said earlier, we tailor it to whether they're batting, bowling, whatever they're doing. One thing that we guide them on that's pretty much the same for all of them is breakfast. So they would all eat, Ben or any all-rounder or a batter or a bowler. We have almost a minimum that we go, guys, this is the minimum amount without, you know, boring your listeners. And we give it them in body weight of, and they know what that looks like of what you should eat at breakfast. So kind of what I described earlier. And then what we would do is, once we know the toss, if we're fielding first, then we would manipulate the strategy. So for example, you know, as an example, if we know that we're bowling first and Ben would be included in that, all our bowlers would have, as I said, our top up, probably our wicket keeper would as well.
So that's a smoothie or something, is it?
Yeah, generally a smoothie. Some of them use like carbohydrate drinks, just some way of getting carbohydrates, them simply. Some of them like to eat, some of them don't like to eat. I'm sure a lot of club cricketers would relate to that, that when you're about to go and run and try and bowl 90 miles an hour, having had another meal, it can be uncomfortable, which is why a lot of them prefer the fluid option of a smoothie. And then we play it as per the game, how it goes. So, you know, hopefully you're bowling them out by end of day one, but if you're not, and we know we're going to be bowling on day two, we have a strategy where we essentially... We have our 12 men run on a little igloo, which has top-up things in there to keep their energy sustained. And it would be, if you're bowling throughout that first morning spell, we top up again at 12. In their drinks bottle will be specific to what they need. Then we have lunch, and obviously some of them generally can eat, some of them can't eat, depending on where they are in the game. So again, we would manipulate based on that. And we just generally go through the day. And probably the biggest one is our recovery. We have to back up days of play. So as a recovery strategy, they would come off the field and they would have something straight away. And generally that's a shake of some description. So sometimes when they do medium, you might see them with a shaker, and that will be often milk based. So a milk based recovery shake with, you know, we use protein powders and we put banana in there as well. They then will do media and other bits and pieces, and then they'll eat at the ground a meal, so they'll eat again. And then if it's been a massive day and we're fielding again, we'll eat again. So they have two meals, so they'll eat at the ground and then they'll eat back at the hotel or out or wherever they are. And you'll probably be surprised to know we also make fast bowlers have something before bed. They have a glass of milk generally before bed just to top up again and recover. Which in a lot of sports is quite a consistent recovery strategy. If on the flip side we're batting and we've not done anything that day, and hopefully we've got a pairing and they're making double hundreds or whatever, then we would remove certain aspects of that. So they wouldn't necessarily do the pre-bed. They may or they may not, depend on the player. They wouldn't necessarily do a triple recovery. They might do a shake immediately and then a meal later on. But we just tweak it based on who it is, what they're doing, and where we are in the game. As I said, test match cricket is very difficult. T20, our strategies are a lot more set because we know it's 20 overs and we know our bowlers are bowling four and we know our batters hopefully are batting a max of 20 overs. So you can be, as I said, it's a lot more linear. We can be a lot more specific, whereas test cricket is a lot more, you have to educate the lads on what they need and when they need. But lastly, you know, linking back to your original, somebody like Ben, hopefully, will be batting and bowling. So therefore, they are probably our lads, along with our fast bowlers, who have the highest input in terms of energy, because they're going to give the most on the output, all being well, if we're successful in the game. Well, hopefully he's not bowling very much, but, you know, hopefully he's batting for a long period of time.
Wow, it's a real science. And a final question, where is this heading? What's the next sort of innovation or development in this field?
Going back to what I just said there, every sport has a different question posed in front of them. I think where we're at, I think, is individualisation. We put some great basics in and we're doing some really good things, but whether it's training or whether it's nutrition and whether it's recovery, it's individualising those strategies. So for example, in terms of their training, I wouldn't run players exactly the same to get aerobically fitter. I wouldn't train Dan Lawrence the same as I would Joe Root. They're different. They're made up differently. Joe Root is aerobically he can keep going all day. Dan Lawrence is a speed man. He's your 100 meter guy. So working out where they sit on these continuums and how they respond best and differently, you can then individualize their training. And that's why you will see, hopefully you will see, there might be 3, 4, 5 guys on the field, but they're doing different things. And why is he running only 100 meters and doing something there while, you know, he's doing laps and laps and laps? There's a reason for that. And I think we're starting to get there, starting to kind of unravel things from a training point of view. I think nutritionally we're starting to get there and consider that, and they're aware of that. I think recovery is one area that I think generally sports science is chasing in general, and there'll be some big developments in years to come. So if we can individualise what's happening at that level for all players, then you'll see another leap forward.
Emma, if you had one food source that you sort of just say is an absolute banker, a dead cert, and one that's an absolute no-no, what are they?
Can I go quite broadly? Because this applies to all levels of cricket. Carbohydrates. So many meals in cricket do not focus on the key nutrient that it should. So, you know, if we look, as we said, historically, they're very high fat. They're quite high, you know, high in fat, essentially, and probably more protein-based. When ironically, they need to be more carbohydrate-based. So I'd say the absolute winner, you know, if for any cricketer, is switch out your hash brown and sausage and bacon for some toast or a bowl of cereal or Weetabix or porridge or a banana. Like, that in itself will make a difference. Absolute no-goes. I think there's none that, you know, I don't have any forbidden foods that nobody can eat. But my advice would be pick your time to eat them and think about performance. What do I need to perform? As we said, you could say a beer, but is a beer going to help you perform optimally in the middle of a test match? Probably not. So pick it at the end of day 5. Like, you know, that's how we work it, you know, in England. It's nothing's forbidden, but just think about what, when and where.
I can't imagine that a lamb a lamb curry would be ideal at lunch, really. It would sort of, it would sit in my stomach and just inhibit any movement, I would have thought.
Yeah, you're right. And that's where, again, we're quite fortunate in the sense that, you know, I will send a very short 2-page document to our grounds that will say, please could we avoid these things at lunch? And it will often be, you're right, heavily spiced foods, heavy red meats, heavy cream, that kind of thing, that just generally for any person, regardless whether you sat at a desk or you're trying to run around a field, would make you feel sluggish and lethargic. But, you know, one of the things that I love about cricket, and I'm sure the lads do, is we're fortunate. We get to travel all over the world and experience cuisines. And a lot of people assume that we don't eat that cuisine when we go away. We absolutely do. We just try and enjoy the experience of that cuisine, but tailor it to, as you know, so it might be that we ask them to swap that curry for a rice-based dish that day instead, because, again, it's better for what we need. Or, you know, we might ask them to tweak it slightly to be more orientated and put the curry at the pulse match meal so we can enjoy it afterwards when they've stopped running around. But yeah, it's one of the things that I love about cricket, and we get to experience some amazing foods and, you know, cultures, and, you know, we get to see the world whilst doing it, which is amazing.
Very interesting. Thank you. I've learned a lot. It sounds as if Jack Russell, with his stewed Weetabix in milk for 15 minutes, was on the right line.
Absolutely.
On the money.
So just to finish then, go on, tell us, what would be a good daily diet for a player about to play a cricket match, maybe a club player, maybe a fast bowler? What would you prescribe?
You know, for an average male cricketer, it could be, let's say they're a fast bowler, it could be 2 Weetabix with milk and a banana, and then let's say 2 slices of toast with scrambled egg and smoked salmon, as an example. Then we'll make it simple, we'll say before play, a banana. And then their lunch break, you know, let's just pick an example of what our lads would eat. It might be, you know, pasta with a chicken breast and vegetables, broccoli, as an example.
Yeah.
And then mid-afternoon or tea break, it might be, our lads would have something like a chicken wrap with a smoothie. And then it would be evening meal. And that would be, again, something along the lines of, say, salmon with stir-fry noodles and vegetables, you know, a pretty balanced meal. And then before bed, this is a key one, a glass of milk.
If one of your early questions was, can you still enjoy food? That's a tasty day.
Yeah. But that would be, a pretty standard day for, you know, for anybody.
Okay.
And would suffice.
Well, I hope you found that interesting, listening to Emma Gardner, the England nutritionist, and Phil Scott, their main trainer, and hearing about what they eat and what they shouldn't eat. And actually, it's reassuring to hear that they've probably still allowed a few treats now and then. It gives you an insight, actually, into what they might be eating in the Trent Bridge dressing room during the Test match, which is about to start, England against New Zealand, the second Test in Nottingham. Actually, I used to love the food at Nottingham, particularly these great big baps with cheese and ham stuffed in them for tea. I used to gorge on those. So I don't know if they're still allowed, but maybe they are. Anyway, that's it for this week. So my next guest is a lady who has invented something called the Eye Gym. She's known actually as the Eye Lady. She's someone who is totally reinventing the way that people, athletes, sports players use their eyes in their respective disciplines. So I hope you'll join us for the next issue of the Barest of Margins. Don't forget also back issues like my interview with Stephen Scully and the Irish Olympic runner, and all the insights that somebody like that can give in terms of running and preparation and training and so on. And also the one before that was with John Gloucester, the lead trainer of the Rajasthan Royals in the IPL, and him talking about sleep and the importance of it, and especially how to sleep better. Don't forget my other podcast as well, of course, The Analyst Inside Cricket, which provides a regular digest on all that's going on in the cricket world and a daily update, a daily review of each day's play in England's Test matches. Hope you can catch one of those. In the meantime, thanks for listening.
Sports
Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy. Interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood? Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit caneighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello.